Hello and welcome to Volume 156 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss a new geological survey that could impact landowners in central Alabama. We'll learn more about a cost-share program to battle the southern pine beetle. We'll hear more about a teaching farm that can assist in workforce development. And we'll discuss how to make money by allowing people to camp on your property. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is Patrick Heisel. He's an associate professor of forest operations at Clemson, and he recently authored an article in Forest Landowner that caught our eye. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Hayes. How are you doing?
Great. I just wanted to talk with you about something related to your line of work, and you're helping forest landowners make money off their timberland. It seems like landowners are always looking for a way to make money in between harvest, which can be quite a ways away. What is a source of income that you've explored recently?
There's out hunting leases very common in the southeast. There's carbon credits and deferred harvests that are happening. I work with some landowners that do cabin rentals on their forest land, but some of the latest that I have come across is primitive camping. And, you know, primitive camping is just what it sounds like. It's just camping with a tent somewhere in a forest, you know. And it's kind of unique in a way that the campers kind of buy the exclusive rights for the day or the weekend to be on your forest land, and they have a fairly large chunk of forest land available to them without any other campers.
So privacy is an important part of this, and this is not something that fits well with other activities that are going on the property at the same time.
That is correct. So most of these campers, they want to be left alone. I work with a private landowner here in South Carolina, and his clientele, the guests that he basically has camping on his forest land, are people that come from the bigger cities around, all the way down Florida, all the way up to New York, right? And they want to just hang out for the weekend, do some camping, have some fun, but they don't want to see any other people. They don't even want to see the landowner too much. They want the interaction to get to their campsite, and then they want to be left alone and enjoy that privacy, that serenity of being in a forest, right?
Okay. Tell us how primitive camping works and what a forest owner should be on the lookout for.
So with primitive camping, it's really easy because there's no facilities. As a landowner, you don't need to have anything other than a forest and a spot where somebody could pitch a tent. And that site doesn't even have to be level. So the sites that I know that I work with my landowner here, they're all on a slight slope, nothing to graze, and people are more than happy to go there and camp. What really helps landowners to attract campers to their site if they have, like, some unique features on their forest land. Like a campsite that is close to a stream goes over really well, gets booked a lot. If there's a small lake or something that a campsite is on, of course, that goes really well. Campsites in the middle of a pine plantation, they do sell out occasionally, but they're not as frequently visited as some sites that, like, you know, on a stream, or maybe have a great view of the mountains or something like that.
But when you talk about camping, are you talking about someone driving up in an RV, or are you talking about backpacking in or walking in a ways to the site?
Great question. It's actually backpacking in and literally pitching a tent. So most of the campsites that I know have only foot access. So the car has to be parked, you know, a couple hundred feet or so or more away from the campsite, and then people actually just bring their camping gear in, pitch their tent, and they're more than willing to do so.
Okay.
Right. So that's quite something different.
What income do you think could be expected from some of this? I guess it depends on what amenities that you have and what kind of costs are associated with setting something up like this.
All right. So most campers that I know pay about $40 to $50 per night per person just to have the right to camp on your forest land. There's a few websites out there that help you, similar to Airbnb, right? So websites where you can post your campsite, and then they manage all the organization, the scheduling, and then that website takes a small fee from the payment that you would get to basically orchestrate the whole deal, and then also provides you with some liability insurance. So, you know, obviously camping mostly happens in the summertime, so you have maybe a 3-4 months window where you get campers. Most campers only come on the weekends. So, you know, if you get one camper, one group per weekend, you're looking at maybe $200 a month, maybe more. Like the landowner I work with, he has a few sites on a lake and on a stream, and they book out, I think, from May until October every single weekend. But it depends on what kind of forest land you have, what kind of site you have, and how attractive it is to the people that want to camp there.
Okay, sure. Well, thanks, Patrick. We appreciate you taking time to tell us about this very much.
Absolutely, not a problem.
Dane Vandervoot is a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey of Alabama. He's involved in a project that's surveying the central part of Alabama for minerals, including graphite. Welcome, Dane.
Thank you very much.
Why is the USGS conducting this survey in Alabama, of all places?
Yeah, so this geophysical survey was performed as part of a larger effort by the U.S. Geological Survey to identify domestic sources of critical minerals, with a specific survey being conducted in order to refine the known extent of Alabama's historic flake graphite resources. Alabama has some of the richest flake graphite deposits in the conterminous United States, and the state was at one time one of the nation's leading producers of this material. As your listeners may recall from the last time we spoke, there's a lot of interest in Alabama's graphite, and there are currently two companies looking to develop resources here, including Westwater Resources, Inc., who are soon to be opening up a graphite processing plant in Kellyton, and South Star Battery Metals Corporation, who are reevaluating the old Ceylon mine south of Sylacauga.
Well, what is it about graphite that interests the USGS? I mean, how many pencils do we really need?
Well, so this is more for graphite that's used for batteries green energy stuff. And so the interest in graphite, again, it's part of the federal overall initiative to identify domestic sources of critical minerals. And this is being done in order to cut our nation's dependence on foreign imports and to decrease our nation's susceptibility to market manipulation and trade restrictions. Critical minerals are high-demand commodities that are vital to the economy and security of our nation. And these commodities are essential to the manufacturing, transportation, energy, and defense industries, and there are no or very few substitutes available. So out of the 50 minerals deemed critical by the federal government, the U.S. is 100% reliant on imports to supply our needs for 12 of them and 50% reliant on imports to supply the needs for another 31. And so the leading import source for a large portion of these commodities is China, which itself has a growing domestic need for critical minerals in order to support their own growth. And growing hostilities with China could threaten a lot of our supply chains for a lot of these resources. So,
okay. Once you obtain the survey data, how is it going to be used and published and made available?
So it'll be made available by the USGS sometime later this fall. But as far as its uses, aside from really helping to refine the known and maybe potentially identify some potentially unknown flake graphite resources in Alabama, this data can be used by geologists to locate potential geologic hazards or to identify potential groundwater resources, which often occur along faults in this part of the state. And that will also help us geologists to clarify some of the structural complexities surrounding the formation of the Southern Appalachian. Really, it's specifically interested in graphite, and there are other applications for it, but it's kind of a real niche thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unusual and located in Alabama, so that's good. Well, thanks, Dane. We appreciate it very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Our next guest is Austin Reese, who is a forest health coordinator with the Alabama Forestry Commission. He's administering a cost share program that's aimed at the southern pine beetle. Welcome, Austin.
Hi. Thank you for having me on today.
First, many people are not familiar with the southern pine beetle. Tell us how an infestation occurs in the first place.
Sure. So the southern pine beetle is one of the most destructive pests that we have for pine plantations here in the south. An infestation usually occurs when the pine species becomes stressed by another factor in their environment, such as drought, overcrowding of a stand, lightning strike. Essentially, the pine beetle is not going to infest a perfectly healthy pine unless it's a terrible outbreak year. Something else has to stress those trees beforehand. And essentially, that notes, in that case, the pine beetle acts like a vulture and takes advantage of the pine tree's weakened state.
Okay. Yeah, drought and crowded conditions are something that we have a lot of now. Are there ways to prevent it from occurring in the first place?
Yes, sir, there are. Landowners can reduce the risk of the SPB infestation by either thinning out their stands so remaining pines will have more individual growing space so they're not having to compete as much for water and nutrients, other resources that they need to grow. They can also reduce understory vegetation competition so the pines won't have to compete with smaller vegetation growing on the forest floor. And also when you establish pine stands, depending on which species you plant, there is a certain trees per acre planting range that is encouraged for landowners to use that will prevent an SPB infestation in the first stage of the pine plantation's cycle.
Okay. Well, how does let's turn to the cost share program itself. How does it assist landowners? Are y'all going to build a pulp mill somewhere or what?
So with the Southern Pine Beetle Prevention Cost Share Program, landowners who are accepted to the program, well, for this year, they can apply for either understory burning, first commercial thinning, or low-density loblolly pine planting. Those that are accepted will have from October of this year, 2023, through September of 2024 to complete the practice they are accepted for. And following the completion of that practice, our personnel will come out, inspect the site, make sure that the thinning has been done correctly, the trees per acre is correct for the planting, or that the burning was done correctly to reduce the understory competition. Following that check, landowners will submit their expenses to us, and from there, once that's all been verified, they will be reimbursed a flat rate per acre.
Okay. All right. So it can include thinning as well, commercial type thinning or pre-commercial thinning?
First commercial.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. Well, thanks, Austin. Appreciate that very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
Our final guest is an extension coordinator with the Tuscaloosa County Extension. We've invited John Cameron to tell us more about a teaching farm that was created to highlight the importance of agriculture and forestry for students. Hello, John.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
How did this teaching farm idea come to be, and what is its purpose exactly?
The origin of it was our office works with all the career tech ag classes in the county, and we do some collaboration with community gardens and those type of things. And these ag programs have their own little areas at their sites, and we work with them on hoop houses and that kind of stuff. And the county school system had acquired 70 acres to do some future construction on, and because of a vote failure that they ended up not being able to do that because of the tax issue. And our ag teacher over there at Tuscaloosa County High School called us and said, hey, I think I've got an idea. And we had been working with him for years, and he said, I want to use this. It's right up the road. It's accessible. I drive a bus, and we've got 240 kids that run through this program every year, and we want to get them out on a farm where they can be do something practical and pragmatic to learn how to farm. And one of the issues with that is, and one of the reasons that we're doing it is because the average age of the farmer is 58 in the state of Alabama, and in 10 or 12 years, we're going to end up with an issue where we don't have them anymore. So that's kind of the origin, and the purpose is to get people into it and to open some eyes and some awareness to where that the ag is not a 30-horse tractor and a straw hat anymore. There's some tech involved in it, and it's not just growing crops. It's forestry and animal science and all these other kinds of things, and water conservation and those kinds of things. So that's kind of the origin and the purpose of it.
Mm-hmm. Want to know who could benefit from the program. I can imagine the students themselves would benefit, but do the benefits extend beyond the students?
They do. We work through the West Alabama Chamber of Commerce every year at Shelton State at our Worlds of Work in the ag area with the industries around here that are involved in ag, whether it be PICO or Westervelt or whoever it is, you know, Alabama Forestry Commission. We work with all of those people in job and recruitment and training, and that's, you know, other than the students, we're running 240 or so, and the impact from it's going to be 5,000 or 6,000 kids a year because of the orientation with the elementary and middle schools, trying to get them involved and opening their eyes to what ag is. But the benefit of it for the industry around here is to replace employees that are retiring or have moved to another area. I think Tuscaloosa is just like any other area of the state. We've got a fairly low unemployment rate, but we've also got a low participation rate in the labor market, and we've got these industries around here that are looking for people to work, and they need trained people, and that's kind of the reason that we're doing that, this whole project to begin with, and that's kind of the benefit of it is getting those people into that. So, you know, we're an automotive and manufacturing-rich area of the state. We've got oil and tires and automotive industry and those kinds of things, but, you know, there's timber all around us, and there's agriculture all around us, and we're trying to promote the recruitment of that into those areas.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned the labor participation rate. That's an entirely different thing from the unemployment rate. What's the expected outcome in terms of things like workforce development, and specifically for the ag sector?
We're hoping that we can provide some students that are hired to retire in these areas, in these industries, that come out with some stackable credentials through dual enrollment with Alabama Community College System, whether it be Shelton State, Bevel, or Wallace, or whoever it may be. We're also looking for some collaboration with some of the surrounding school systems, and I'm working with the probate and the commission here and the West Alabama Chamber of Commerce on ideas as to how we can increase the outcomes and make it more efficient to where we're getting a younger workforce coming out of high school, whether it be high school or a two-year degree or a four-year degree, or whatever their choice is. And we're hoping that we can get students that are in an industry where they can get these stackable credentials and reduce the student debt on these people too. Everybody's going to benefit from it. And that's what we're hoping. It's taken a lot of people. It's grown from an idea with three guys to something that's gotten pretty big in the last month or so, and we're really looking for some help as it relates to whether it be Alabama Ag and Industries or the statewide workforce development to get this in place so that everybody benefits from it. So that's our projected outcomes are to make sure the industry benefits, the students benefit, and the school system benefits.
Good. Well, thanks, John. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
All the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Patrick Heisel, Dane Vandervoot, Austin Reese, and John Cameron. An article written and published yesterday by Margaret Cates on AL.com highlighted the concern by environmentalists about the emerging wood pellet industry in Alabama. They say the manufacture of wood pellets can cause serious harm to the environment, including air pollution. And they cast doubt on the claim that this is a renewable energy source. Alabama has had 4 new pellet mills located since 2019. The pellets are shipped to Europe and Asia to be used to produce energy instead of using other things like coal. I'm reminded of the snake that ate his tail, mistaking himself for the cause of distress. These facilities that use wood spent billions in reorganizing their business model and did so to eliminate an environmental catastrophe. And yet when this extraordinary action is taken, they're not met with praise by environmentalists, but scorn for causing environmental harm in order to prevent environmental harm. It seems like you just can't please everybody. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.